dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones? And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back? Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I am your big, fat, obnoxious host, Stank Dog, and I am on the phone with our good friend, Voodoo Hal, as the co-host today. Say hello to the people, Voodoo Hal.
What's up, guys, in my very creative way.
And we are coming to you, originally aired on February 24th, 2004. That's kind of an interesting 02242004. Only three numbers in that stream. We only had a couple emails this time, but they were good ones. So, as usual, I guess I start off every show and say we're going to jump into the email. So this time we jump into the email, we dive into the email. Let's, fart into the email. What else can we do? I don't know what else to do with the email. I guess let's wade into the email. There we go. That's a good one. And our first email is from Sub-Zero, our good friend, and he says, quote, he's following up, first of all, I'll set this up, he's following up on our talk about port knocking a couple of episodes ago. He says, I was talking to one of my friends about the port knocking that you were talking about on the show, and he brought up some interesting points. We talked about OSI standards. With it, there is never a guarantee that packets will get there, and if they do, in the right order. If this were implemented, a person would have to continue to send packets in sequence until they arrive in the correct sequence. If you are dealing with this on a small or business internal network, it would almost be overkill. It could cause a worldwide priority of packets, in which a user could start sucking up a lot of bandwidth. Am I totally off, or are these ideas reasonable? Yes, they're definitely reasonable, and something that we talked about before. But to get a more authoritative answer, I went straight to the source. I went to a great source, Martin Kay, from portknocking.org, the site we mentioned before, and I posed this question to him, and he was gracious enough to give us a response. And his response is that this question isn't a new one, but it's a very, very valid one. I don't know if I have an answer, though. One of the limitations of port knocking and its current incarnation include the packet order problem. In networks where the latency can be anticipated, it's probably good enough to send the packets spaced apart further than the latency time. That makes sense, I guess. Unfortunately, good enough isn't good enough for a production environment in which port knocking is used and relied upon. A number of potential extensions include packaging the knock in packet as data payload. This is something implemented by Doorman. Although this drastically changes the approach, no more knocking on ports, data is still sent across a closed port. You have to delve deeper into the firewall to extract the packet payload, thus harder, but the packet order problem is mitigated, thus easier. Best regards, Martin. So Martin K., thank you very much. And he's probably laughing because I'm calling him Martin K., and he knows why. That makes very good sense. It's a perfectly valid question. And I didn't think about this in terms of a production environment. I just thought of it as a neat idea and something to put around as kind of a game, a little secret, you know, to add this kind of a backdoor underground way to access your own things, your own stuff, hook friends up to be able to access your systems without, you know, really going to a thinking it all the way through to a production environment. If you actually wanted to implement this as some form of security, there's a lot of other problems in addition to this one mentioned here. And the workaround he talked about, to me, isn't even port knocking anymore. I mean, would you consider that port knocking when you actually put the payload, put it into the data into a separate payload packet?
Not really. Not at that point.
I don't think that's really what I was thinking of port knocking at that point. That becomes, I don't know, some other type of authentication. It's not really, I don't really know. It just kind of takes it into a different direction in my eyes. The idea of port knocking and that problem, yes, that is naturally associated with it. However, I don't know that I would ever implement this in a production environment. And I would be interested, and maybe Martin can follow up and let me know this if he listens, if there are any places that he's aware of, and we don't have to name names, of course, but are there places that are implementing port knocking as a production environment type of authentication or type of access? If there are any production environments, businesses, schools, et cetera, that are actually using this, I had assumed that it probably would not be. A, because it's a fairly new, recently popular, I should say, I don't know how new, but recently popular phenomenon. So that reason, as well as the fact that to put anything in a production environment, you really do your research to make sure it's safe and secure, dependable, reliable, and all of that. And I don't know that it's been around long enough to determine those things.
Unless it's a Microsoft product.
Well, yeah, that's coming up later in the show. So thank you. Thank you to Sub-Zero and to Martin for that email and response. I think he said it really well. I think he explained it very well. I got another email from Pixelfiend, and I you know what? It's kind of funny. I knew he was going to email because he admits that he's a Mac junkie. He's a Mac evangelist, I think is what he said, jokingly, of course. And he says that he loved the Mac Talk last episode, and he actually had a follow-up on a comment that Logan 5 made. He says, referring to Logan 5, he did mention that mounted servers do not appear on the desktop. By default, they don't for some reason. That can be changed through the Finder preferences. Finder menu, preferences, general tab. There's a checkbox for showing mounted servers on the desktop. Also, OS X does come with cron built in. That's a question that I actually brought up on the show. But like Logan 5 said, there's no GUI front end in the OS. Sure, Joe Blow won't know how to use it, but cron works just great, and I have my doubts as to whether Joe Blow could use it with a GUI either, which is also probably true. So thank you very much for the your Mac ideas and comments, Pixelfiend. You know, we always welcome hearing from you. And for the listeners, there's a couple more Mac tips and some ideas of where this stuff is at and how you can tweak it and customize it a little bit. So that's a very good thing. Now, I know you're not a Mac guy, but you know you have some Mac experience. Have you had time to listen to the OS X episode yet?
Somewhat, yeah.
And did you have anything to add, or was there anything in there that you thought was left out?
Not really, no.
How much have you used, what is it, not Jaguar, but Panther?
Yeah, I've owned probably 7 or 8 Macs now. And, I mean, I'm slowly becoming more of a Mac user. I have had an 800 megahertz iBook as well. And the only thing that I wanted to stress, I think you asked, is it worth it in terms of, you know, going from Jaguar, spending the money on Panther? And it's definitely worth it.
They've improved
the whole project speed-wise and tremendously. It's night and day, at least for me.
So it's not...
You asked what the slowest machine it would run on. I had it running on, you know, a 400 megahertz old Tangerine iMac, and it ran quite well.
So the jump from Jaguar to Panther is not like just another service pack release. There is actually some meat and something substantial in there to upgrade?
Definitely. Performance-wise, I mean, for me, it was night and day. Also, he kind of touched on Exposé a little bit. Exposé is, you know, one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
And what is that exactly?
Exposé was the function he was talking about on how you can hit one button or one gesture, depending on how you've got it set up, to minimize, not necessarily minimize all your windows, but size them all as they size them all and select the one you want, and they'll resize the full screen. And, I mean, it's one of the coolest things, and it doesn't really, at least for me, it wasn't apparently obvious for a while until I started doing a lot of things that required a lot of windows, because normally I don't. Normally I have my term and, like, one other thing open, possibly an AIM client or an iChat client, and I'm done. I mean, I'm happy with a term. I'm good to go.
Right. Well, at home I'm like that, but at work that would come in really handy because I leave a lot of different windows open. I use a lot of different type of editors, several SSH sessions and Telnet sessions of different types of Telnet sessions that I don't want to close out, so that could be really handy to me. But I'm not a Mac guy. Freely admit that, and that's why I've been trying lately to get one of those, what do they call it? Is it just called an iMac? See, my terminology is, I just want one of the iMacs with the colors that that they had on the commercials years ago. I figure those are about to be cheap by now.
Yeah, the color ones are just iMacs. I bought my 400 megahertz iMac for like $225, so they're not bad at all.
Yeah, if I can get one for a couple hundred bucks to play with and get used to it, see if I like it, because I've heard great things about the iBook. In theory, from looking at them and watching people use them and hearing, it sounds like it's a great, great machine, but I don't want to sink that much into it until I get used to it and understand it, see if I like it first.
Yeah, see, I spent, a couple hundred bucks and bought two old Power Macs and two even older Power Macs before the G3s. But the two G3s I bought, they were only two 33s, but just the experience alone from that made me, want to buy more. So we bought the iMac, and then we bought the iBook. And just recently sold the iBook so I can buy a PowerBook.
Well, speaking of Mac, this is actually a good segue into talking about the distributed.net team. This is a housekeeping. I bring it up every once in a while, once every month or two. And it's very fitting to follow up on Pixel Fiend's email because Pixel Fiend is putting up mad, mad numbers on the distributed. He's only been on there for 8-9 days, less than 2 weeks, a little over a week. And he's jumped halfway up the list already. So those Macs, dude, are crunching some keys. Now, why is it that the Mac is crunching keys so much faster than an Intel? I've got P4s running on it. I don't have, I guess a 64-bit processor might help some, but a P4 you would think would be competitive, but from what I see, it's getting its ass handed to it by these G4s.
Well, first of all, a 64-bit processor probably won't help you unless they decided to rewrite it doing some creative things. But the reason why the Mac can just easily blow away an Intel box in this is because the Intel box doesn't have what's called a rotation instruction. The Macs have, a lot of things added to the architecture that help it in number crunching, period. Same with a lot of different RISC-based architectures, which a Mac is RISC. It's a PPC form. And basically what that means is when Intel has to do these rotations on the numbers, it's taking, five or six, and these are, the total number here is just arbitrary for me. I don't know how many instructions it would take to do this. But what you're looking at is hardware-based rotation, which would take one or two cycles, maybe more, I don't know, I would say one or two, compared to six or seven instructions that have to emulate these rotations. Which that alone is a tremendous difference. But Macs also have this brilliant thing called AltaVec, which you guys can look up on Google. It's really hard to explain in a short amount of time, but it's basically, is a way of creating concurrent processing on data without actually having multiple processors. It's absolutely brilliant.
And I'm sorry, what was that called again?
It's called AltaVec, A-L-T-I-V-E-C.
Okay.
Basically, it's 128-bit, call it a buffer in this case, and that, I don't know if any of you guys ever worked on clustering type things, you have different types of data and instructions. You have multiple data, multiple instructions, or multiple instructions, multiple data, or that's the same thing. but this is basically multiple instruction, or single instruction, multiple data, which means it can, as long as you can line up the data you want to work with in a single memory space, it can do the same instructions on multiple pieces of data at the same time. So, for instance, if you have this array, and it's 120 bits, so you can get 16 bytes into this array. So if you have a 16-byte or 16-character array that you're wanting to do manipulations on, using the AlphaFig engine, you can do the manipulations on that single array at the exact same time. And that's best-case scenario. Obviously, you could do it on 32-bit pieces, which in that case there would be four, but you could do it on the same time. So that's one
right.
thing that makes AlphaVec extremely fast and makes the G4 work really well.
Yeah, obviously, because it's just blowing up. But also, the team in general is blowing up. I mean, we've got 39 members, and I kind of thought we'd hit a point where we were just going to hover around 300, break the top 300, maybe slowly climb up one place every couple weeks. And we're still climbing in the rankings, man. We're still moving up. We're up to 39 people, and everybody putting in, I keep saying it, everybody put in a little bit, and it adds up, and it really, really is. This is a long-term project, so it doesn't matter if you put up big numbers every day or one day. Of course, it helps, obviously. But putting up a few numbers every day or every other day or even once a week, you know, even just whenever they get done, let it upload. The only thing is make sure you go there in the forums. We have a distributed.net forum that explains how to get this client and everything set up. And I know most people can do that on their own, but there are two main projects that are open. And one of them is the RC5 project, and that's the one that we are taking part in. There's also an OGR project, which is cool. That's fine and dandy and everything, but by default, they're both turned on. And what it'll do is it'll run through the RC5 keys that it needs cracked. Then it will run through some OGR keys. So you need to disable that so that what happens is once it finishes all its RC5, it'll grab more. If you don't disable that, by default, it's working on two projects, and when it finishes one, it starts on a whole different project, and it may take it a week to crunch on the OGR stuff, and then once it finishes both, only then will it go back and get more data. So go check out the forums, and it has some details, and I know there were some problems, Linux problems that some people were working on, workarounds for that are posted there as well, and make sure you've got it not only running, but running efficiently. So, that's all for that, and I won't bug anybody about that for a couple more weeks. Now, we're going to move into the show-and-tell portion of the show, as I like to call it. Even though I can't really show anything to the listeners, I can tell them what we've been working on recently. And I was out of town this weekend, as Voodoo Hal knows, because he heard all the background noise from where I was. And while I was out, I was just basically doing some retail hacking, which is, I don't know, it's almost subconscious now. I just do it everywhere I go anyway. I posted something in the forums that I was at the UPS office, and they had some systems there. Didn't have a whole lot of time to play with them, but I played with them just to see what they were, just curiosity factor to see what they're running and what they're doing. I was up in Orlando, Florida for the weekend, and in the hotel room there, I guess it's not really retail hacking, I guess. It's a hotel, but I don't know if it classifies or not. But anyway, did a little some checking out some information in the hotel room, wrote down some numbers and some information I don't quite want to reveal yet, and probably it's, even for hackers, it's probably boring, but got some research I want to do, some follow-up stuff on basically the hotel's on-demand system. So I'm going to do a little research on that, see if I can find anything interesting. And other than that, I, just today as a matter of fact, got in an order I had put in with Blacklisted 411 magazine, which I think we've talked about on the show before, but if not, here we go. Blacklisted 411 was a hacker magazine that came out, I don't know when they officially started, but I remember seeing them around 95, 96, somewhere in that range, and at that point they were, I'll look at one I have right now. It's January 95, Volume 2, Issue 1. So I guess there was a Volume 1 1 year early, so I guess they must have started in 94, possibly 93. I don't know what their numbering scheme is. But anyway, this was a magazine. It's the same format as 2600 and Binary Revolution. I think the same company. I wouldn't swear about this, but I think they also put out Thud, THUD, which was the Hackers Underground Digest. I think they also put that out, but I don't think it lasted very long. And actually, Blacklisted, I think, didn't last too awful long. It's, see, the last issue that I can figure out was in 98, and then they disappeared from bookshelves. Do you have any information to the contrary?
No, I've actually never even heard of them. So.
Oh, really? Yeah, they were similar in format to 2600. All from what I remember, they were all black and white covers, and all black and white interior. When Thud, the Hackers Underground Digest, which I think was made by them, that I remember having color covers, but at least I think I have two issues of that. And I remember that had color covers, but I think Blacklisted, I don't think they ever started with color until apparently recently they've come back out. And you know what, forgive me, I did not write down the URL, but I think it's blacklistedmag.net, but I wouldn't swear by that. I'll post in the show notes the site to Blacklisted. They are another hacking zine, and apparently they're coming back around, I don't know if I should say back in business, but they're releasing hacking magazines again. So I ordered some of the back issues that I was missing and got them pretty quickly. I didn't get the current issue. They said they were out of them right now, temporarily, and they're having more printed. So I don't know what their current issue is, their second incarnation, if they're any good or what the content is like, but if and when I get it, I will read it and review it and talk about it on the show. And if any of the listeners have it or wanted to make comments about it, by all means, email us, radio@benrev.com, in case you don't know it by now.
This is Blacklisted 411, right?
It's Blacklisted 411 Magazine.
The URL is www.blacklisted411.net.
Okay, blacklisted411.net. And you can order through, I think, online, and they have subscriptions and stuff like that. They've done this before. Again, they've, like I said, they were out before. They were carried in, I don't know which chains, but they were carried in major bookstore chains. I remember seeing it next to 2600 Magazine. So they have the connections, and they are out there. So you might be able to find those in your local bookstore in the magazine section, so keep an eye out for it. But if not, I think you can order online as well. I'm not sure. So I just got those today, and I don't know, I'm actually kind of curious. I'm going to go back and read these from 95, 96 and see what kind of information is in there. It's probably outdated, but you never know, you may find something in there that's, if nothing else, nostalgic, if nothing else. So that's what I'm going to be doing over the next few days, and I guess that's it for me. Nothing super duper exciting, like, you know, setting up a Counter-Strike server.
Nice segue.
There you go.
yeah, that's basically what I'm. That's always pretty much all I've done.
No, it's not.
Exciting. Okay, yeah, whatever. yeah, we're setting up a dedicated Counter-Strike server, as some of you saw on the forums. Right now, it's hosted on a whopping dual 333, but soon we'll be on a dual 733. And also been working on the DDP Hack radio server. Hopefully we'll have that done soon and going.
Woot!
To Stank's exacting specifications.
Exacting because, damn it, I couldn't get that stupid plug-in. Well, I shouldn't say plug-in. Whatever. You know what? Whatever. Not even worth talking into it. All I'm saying is Shoutcast sucks. Yes,
right.
I know Shoutcast worked. It wasn't Shoutcast's fault, but I'm still saying Shoutcast sucks. I'm not impressed.
Hey, I'm agreeing with you. The second part is part of yours, too, so whatever.
Yeah.
and here's an update on a Counter-Strike shootout. I won. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
I would have won if I would have actually banded everybody. Shouts go to Digital Attrition for kicking everybody's ass.
How badly?
Pretty bad. He's pretty good. Somebody else was there, and he's not a forum member that I know of. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. If somebody wants to email me that name, I'll post as a second place person. I think he said he was friends with somebody.
How many people were on totally at playing at one at any given time?
I think at most at once we had eight or so. But man, I at least had some just horrific technical problems. It's funny, I felt like I was whining the whole time, but the guys at Data Machine were nice enough to host us. Completely appreciative to those guys. We had to move the server because the ping times were a little bit low, but obviously they have other things going on, so I completely understand and want to say thanks to those guys. So we moved it, and I decided to host it here. And then from the start, I just knew things were going bad because my machine in the middle of the game, I would stop rendering polygons completely and just render the interface. So, I mean, I was completely blind, and then all of a sudden my machine would just restart a couple minutes later. No biggie. That one, you know, happened once or twice, but no big deal. What really sucked is in the middle of a round, my monitor starts going fuzzy, and I hear this loud pop, and all of a sudden my monitor's gone.
Oh, not cool.
I was plagued with technical problems the whole time, which doesn't, you know, mean that's why I sucked, but it's a good reason, I suppose. So thanks, everybody, for showing up for that, and hopefully we can do that more often.
Well, see, and that was just kind of a impromptu thing. You and I talked about it on the phone one day and thought it might be a neat thing. And, again, like I said, I was out of town, unfortunately, and I couldn't play, but hopefully I'll get on next time and hand out some whoop ass. But, watch, talk shit, and then I'll get my ass handed to me. Oh, man, I just used more bad words in the last 3 seconds than I have in the last 3 months. Man, how did that happen? That wasn't cool. Oh, man. I blew it. Oh, well, I guess we must continue.
We're talking about Counter-Strike and see where Sting goes.
Oh, man, dude, while I'm playing Counter-Strike, and I think I've said this on the show before, I used to play years back when I first found it. I completely got addicted to it, and then I finally just had too many other things going on, mostly with the site and getting, you know, projects that I'm working on. So I finally fell into this pattern. We have kind of a LAN club at the university, and we meet every Friday evening after work and play for a few hours every Friday, and I kind of been doing that pattern for a few months. So I don't play regularly. I'm not a total gaming, you know, go out and play every day, every night when I get home. I know there's people out there that just completely own the game, and some of the guys at the LAN party are like that. I mean, they just completely own everybody, headshots all the time. It's completely in a closed environment, so there's no hacks, there's no cheats, there's no whatever you want to call them. I hate it when people call them hacks. They're cheats, damn it. There's no cheats installed. These people are just that good. And I still, even though it's how many years old, I still love playing this game. It's a great game. And now that I see there's interest out there, Voodoo Hal and I have been talking about how can we set this up regularly. You know, can we... What about a bandwidth analysis? We got to decide if we've got the bandwidth between us somewhere that we can leave this up 24/7 when... Anyway, we won't go into the details here on the show, but a possibility of leaving that up and maintaining some statistics and some stuff like that as a fun diversion. It's not really a hacking project, but a fun project, which I think would be cool. I would use it. And maybe I actually teach Voodoo Hal how to play. Well, is there anything else you wanted to bring up?
I think that's it.
Besides calculus and all the high math and super science and nanotechnology and whatever the hell else you're working on.
Yeah, the pain in my ass, no, we'll leave that alone. I might start cuffing myself.
Yeah, I know that song. Well, I guess our main topic this week has to be Microsoft source code being leaked to the Internet. Has to be. I mean, how can we not address this topic? I guess I don't know. It's just so easy. You know, I don't even know how to... It's already known. Most of the listeners know. I guess probably it'd be easy if I just read some of this verbatim from the stories here and maybe chime in if you... Are you still there? Are you there? I think Voodoo Hal just dropped off on us. Okay, well, apparently his cell phone just took a crap, but we're going to keep right on rolling with the Microsoft source code. This beep is me hanging up on Voodoo Hal, and hopefully he'll call back in a second if he can get to another phone. But as I mentioned earlier, Microsoft source code has been leaked to the Internet, and I'm just going to read some of this verbatim to you. Again, most people have seen and heard of this, but... In an effort to protect its, and this is from InfoWorld, which is a trade magazine, in an effort to protect its intellectual property, as if Microsoft had intellectual property. No, I won't go there. That's too easy. Microsoft Corporation is warning Internet users not to download the Windows source code that appeared online last week. They're warning us. They're not asking us. They're warning us. Microsoft is sending warnings to users who search for the source code on peer-to-peer file swapping services and is mailing legal warnings to those who have already downloaded the secret programming code. Secret programming code. Oh, that's great. It sounds like a movie plot. Tom Pilla, a spokesman for the Redmond, Washington-based software manufacturer, said Wednesday. Pilla would not say which peer-to-peer services Microsoft is targeting or how the company is delivering the alerts on the services it doesn't own. These alerts serve to inform users who initiate a search looking for Windows source code that it is illegal to view, download, and share the code, he said. Now, I'm going to interrupt the story for a moment and say I, just for the sake of journalism, went out and checked some peer-to-peer services that I was aware of. And I tried to see if I would get some warnings and pop-up windows. I wanted to see how they were delivering them for the sake of science and study. And I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. I don't know which ones they're using or how they're tracking or finding these people or anything like that. But I didn't see anything up front. Now, maybe I'll get something in the mail in a few days. I know some other people in forums said they got cease and desist letters. I don't know how they got busted or who, you know, how people got found out or discovered. But, you know, I have a famous saying about a horse that I'm not going to repeat on here, but you can't put the source code back in the horse. That's all I'm saying. So it's out there now, and they can send all the letters they want. Even Microsoft doesn't realize and understand that once it's out, it's out. It's done. It's out there. So you can send all the letters you want, but you're never going to get it back. So, anyway. A little bit of the searching I did is I found a lot. I found the file out there a lot. I did not download any of them. I found it out there a lot looking, and what I found interesting was that there were a lot of file names available, and they seemed to be, frankly, framed. I don't know if it's a good word. They seemed to be intentionally spelled in certain ways. They seemed to have intentional rewording or a few. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I have the feeling that Microsoft has sent agents out there to seed a bunch of false downloads, a bunch of false items. I saw several files out there ranging from 60 megs up to 800 megs. And I don't even know how big the real file is. And no, you don't have to email me and tell me how big it is or send it to me or anything like that. I'm not interested. But obviously there's one file size. It's one known leak. So there can't be that many different variations and different zip file sizes, at least not such a wide disparity. A few bytes, one compression algorithm a little bit different than another. So what I'm saying is they've seeded a bunch of false ones, and I do suspect that it's probably Microsoft trying to control it. Similar tactics that the MPAA took with their pirated movies. They go out there and seed false movies, movies under different names, public domain movies under a real movie's name, stuff like that. Tactic that they're popular for using, and they actually have firms that they hire out to do that for them. So I am saying that that's probably Microsoft doing it, but obviously I'm not pointing fingers or making accusations because I don't want Microsoft coming after me. But it goes on to say Microsoft has also sent out hundreds of letters to people, which I just mentioned, who have already downloaded the source code, Pilla said. Many have responded by agreeing not to distribute the code and deleting it from their systems, he said. Pilla would not detail how Microsoft knows who downloaded the code or who received letters. Exactly what I just said. We will take all appropriate legal actions to protect our intellectual property. Today is about communicating, notifying, and explaining to users that downloading, sharing, and viewing of the source code is illegal, Pilla said. Well, if Pilla said so, I guess we all have to abide by that. Microsoft said last week that incomplete portions, by the way, this is just incomplete. I think, again, listeners have heard this story, and I'm kind of rehashing it. That's why I'm going quickly. It's not complete, according to them. It's partial source code, and that's pretty much been confirmed by people who have read it. They agree that it's incomplete. It's just certain parts of the source code. And it's from NT 4.0 and Windows 2000. It's they have started an internal, the company, referring to Microsoft, has started an internal investigation and called in the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation. So the feds are in, the FBI's in here. Pursuing those who have downloaded the code and warning internet users not to download the code is a, quote, natural move, unquote, from Microsoft, said Thor Larholm, a senior security researcher at Pivex Solutions, LLC, in Newport Beach, California, adding he has not downloaded the code himself. Yeah, neither have I, in case I didn't mention that. Microsoft has historically gone to great lengths to defend their copyright, intellectual property, and trade secrets, he said. Companies developing products for the Windows platform should also endure that their employees do not have the leaked source code, as this could impact their operation on their operations and bring a significant liability to the company. That sounds a lot like SCO and their accusations of people using their source code as part of Linux and their threats and lawsuits. So those aren't necessarily successful, but they are working as far as they're trying. So that in and of itself is a pain to people. So, yeah, I guess if they can identify and prove their source code somewhere, that could be a liability. The article goes on to say here, although it is within Microsoft's rights to protect its intellectual property, playing hardball with those who have downloaded it may have an adverse effect on the company's image, says Joe Wilcox, a Jupiter Research senior analyst in Washington, D.C. While the company arguably is the wronged party here, Microsoft may want to carefully consider the larger public image cost of trying to protect a 3.5-year-old source code, he said. The notices run the risk of backlash at a time when Microsoft tries to rebuild a public image tarnished by the U.S. antitrust case. Wilcox said that some people may view Microsoft's tactic as heavy-handed along the lines of the Recording Industry Association of America. Remember that some of the source code trading occurs on the same peer-to-peer networks used for swapping music. Well, yes, like I mentioned that earlier. Also important to point out, this is 3.5-year-old source code, as they mention. I can tell you from experience that in large companies that I've worked for and I've seen firsthand, Microsoft, the way they handle site licensing and give you basically bulk discounts, they, as part of that site license, usually want a sunset support, that is, cancel support on older versions of the operating system. So if your entire organization was running Windows, I don't know, Windows ME for some unbeknown reason, and XP came out and you wanted to sign a site license with XP, usually they work into that site license that you will transfer everything over to Windows XP. They don't want to support the old Windows ME anymore. They want to kind of sunset that and put it out of its misery and kind of drop support for it and focus all their stuff on XP, and they want you to do that as well. So 3.5-year-old source code, I don't know really who that affects. Now, I know a lot of hackers are very big about using the right operating system and the right products, the right code on the right machine. There's nothing wrong. There are plenty of people that run an older machine. We talked earlier about an old iMac, 400 megahertz iMac, and 300, 333s and stuff like that. The Counter-Strike server was running on dual 333s, I believe he said. Pentium 333s. And as long as the operating system exists, people are going to use it for their specific environments and what their goals for that are. Microsoft wants you to not use and look at that old stuff the way they set up their site licenses, yet, ironically, they seem worried about 3.5-year-old source code. What I read into that, I'm reading in between the lines, and this is obviously just my opinion. If anybody differs, of course, feel free to email me and say you're an idiot, but I think a lot of that code still exists in Windows XP. I think that's the bigger fear. I think that a lot of that code, yeah, it's 3.5 years old, but I think they just ported it over. I think they just updated minor parts of it. And if you see how it works, sure, maybe some individual strings within there, some tiny changes, but the overall flow of logic and how modules interact on the OS level, I think still are the same. And I think if they get, if people see that and understand how it works, I think that's their fear, that people are going to be able to not steal the code, but make code very similar, duplicate it, incorporate it into different operating systems or different projects altogether. That's what I think their real fear is. Now, a couple other sources I've got here along the same story. I just picked a couple more interesting points to really analyze the whole thing. And one question is, where did it get released from? Now, I had mentioned back on, I don't even know what episode of the show it was, several episodes back, that they were really pushing recently this phase or this idea of releasing source code to its selected customers, the ones it was closely allied with, and sharing the code with them so that they could co-develop and they could help develop stuff, and working more closely with the operating system and the kernel, and you know, having a better handshake and working better with the environment. And I said on the show then that it's an accident waiting to happen. Somebody's going to get that code and release it. They can be as careful and as safe as they want to. It's going to get out. Now, I don't know if that is the same code, and that is what has happened. I guess it has happened in a way. I don't know if it's the same. It's not the XP code that they're sharing, but it's some type of similar program. Media reports point to Mainsoft, MainSoft, or at least one of its PCs as the culprit. The company, an Israeli-based research and development center, reportedly was working on Linux ports of Microsoft software. If that's not the ultimate irony, I don't know what is. Working on Linux ports of Microsoft software, that's amazing. What person who's running a free operating system, Linux, is going to buy Microsoft products to run on said operating system? I don't think there's a person in the world. Well, no, there's got to be some. There's going to be some dumb ones out there. There's definitely going to be people that will do it. I mean, if you're going to run the Microsoft, I don't know, Office products or whatever products, you're going to do it on a Microsoft server. Just because of the simple fact that you know Microsoft's got you by the short hairs on that. Who's going to run it? And the whole reason you're running Linux is to get away from the whole Microsoft monster. So that's kind of strange. And one last part of this I found was from CNN, believe it or not, and they say, quote, "One main risk in having source code exposed to the public is the possibility that hackers could break into computers running Windows NT or Windows 2000 and destroy or steal data." Doom, 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 doom. Yeah, what kind of... I don't know where they just pulled this stuff out of their ass somehow. I'm so sure that's what they're worried about. It's what, you know, as a matter of fact, here, it goes on to say, and this is what I alluded to earlier, says, although the company said that was unlikely, given the relatively small portion of the code that had been circulating, a greater risk could come from others using the code as a base for developing software that competes with Windows. That's the truth. Not the worry about hackers are going to destroy this and take over machines because we got this. No, that's nothing. That's not what they're worried about. They're worried that somebody's going to take the source code and reverse engineer it, figure out how it works, and use it for their own basis. That's the truth. Let's not, you know, why I don't understand why they throw... Yes, I do understand, and I'm not going to go into that soapbox, but they just, it annoys me, they just want to throw the scary words, hackers are going to steal and break into. Why is that associated? You know? Why? I don't get that. So, anyway, that is the big news, and this is ongoing. I did a little looking to see if I could find any information on, you know, what peer-to-peer services they're checking and where they're looking and how they're looking, but I didn't see anything out there yet. If anybody finds anything, like I said, email us at radio@benrev.com or post it in the forums or even contact me directly. And I will be watching myself. I just want to know out of curiosity, because they're Microsoft, fine, but who are they to go on peer-to-peer and monitor activities on a peer-to-peer service, and what peer-to-peer service is giving them permission or allowing them to do this, or if they're not allowing them, why aren't they doing something to stop them for illegally accessing, you know, violating their terms of service? You know, I believe it was Earth Station 5, and their terms of service said that accessing this for certain intents of looking for certain activities, if you're with law enforcement, stuff like that, the act of accessing the network was a violation of their terms of service. So I don't know what legal standing that has, but I thought that was an interesting comment. So, we will, that's a story that's not going anywhere for a while, and we'll follow up on it as we get more news. When I say we, of course, I guess I mean me, because Voodoo Hal apparently has not called back. I guess his cell phone completely died, or he dropped it in the crapper, one of the two. Oh, I have one other good story I want to cover today, and I call this one Java Goes to Walmart. I get a lot of trade magazines, and I'm a little bit behind on reading them, so this is actually probably an older article. It's from December, eWeek Magazine, which is one of my trade magazines. Well, it's actually pretty good, I have to say. I like it. And this one is about, I mentioned before, Sun's Java desktop system on a previous episode. Actually, episode 26 I have here. Sun is negotiating with Wally World, that would, of course, be Walmart, and Office Depot to include Sun's JDS, the Java Desktop System, on a line of low-cost PCs and laptops. Note that Walmart is expected to come out with a line of low-cost laptops. Now, these are two separate stories we've talked about on the show before. We have mentioned, and on RFA, that Walmart was going to be... Yeah, this is a little Project Walmart Freedom topic. I didn't even preview. I should have said, this is a little Walmart Freedom information. We've talked about before that Microsoft was going to be coming out with a line of low-cost laptops. They still deny it, but it's pretty much become evident, public knowledge, that they're doing it. They just haven't announced it yet. So they're going to come out with low-cost laptops, hardware-wise. And I guess Sun, as I mentioned before, they have that JDS system. They're trying to go out and replace Microsoft to become a new alternative desktop operating system. And I kind of went into a rant, and I'm not going to go into, on episode 26, how I didn't like the idea and how it was replacing one proprietary system with another. Listen to episode 26 for my mini-review on JDS. I think I talked about it on another episode recently, too, but... go back and check out the show notes if you want to listen more about that. Now, one of the interesting points about this is that Sun has predominantly been in the higher-end business market. They stay away from home users. Suddenly, things have changed. Critics are pointing out two things. Firstly, the fact that the supposed target audience who would buy laptops from Walmart would probably want Windows operating system. I don't mean to say this stereotypically, but I guess I am. People buying low-cost laptops are looking for something easy to use. They're not, you know, hardcore users. They're your common Walmartians, to quote our good friends over at RFA. The Walmartians are looking for something cheap and easy to use. So they're not going to want some weird JDS. So they want something that's more familiar and comfortable. Now, I can't wait to see... if they go through with this and they have JDS, Sun's JDS on there as the operating system, I can't wait to see how they handle the returns, because people are going to be returning these things. They're not going to know how they work. They're not going to be able to figure them out. They're going to be returning them to the store left and right. And Walmart's return policy, we know what a pain that can be sometimes. We've talked about that in the past. And the first time it crashes or they screw it up, they're not going to know how to fix it. They're going to have to provide tech support, and I don't think they're ready and have thought that all the way through yet. That's going to be a mess. It's going to be a lot of those returned to Walmarts and a lot of open box items, probably, I predict. Or they may just refuse to return. Well, that remains to be seen anyway. That's stuff I'm sure they're thinking about, or I hope they're thinking about. And they may have made a decision that they're not going to take them. Who knows? I guess we'll find out if and when the time comes. The second fact is what I had mentioned on episode 26, and that is why exchange one proprietary operating system for another one. I mean, Java, when it first came out, was great. It was just this amazing thing that cross-platform development, you know, you can develop for one platform, and it works across any platform because you're working on Java itself, which is portable and blah, blah. All such a great idea, and... had such potential, and now has become infamous for being buggy and crashing systems all the time. It's just completely 180 degrees from what it started out. I mean, Java's just turned into, well, junk. So much so that there are companies out there, and I can tell you this firsthand, there are companies that have banned Java from their desktops. They don't want their users having Java applets and Java runtime libraries and stuff like that on the desktops because they're so buggy and because they cause problems. They actually ban it. I mean, that is sad. Do you know how to have your software banned because it causes so many problems? That's not the reputation you want. Well, I hope this is who I think it is because we are recording, so here we go. Sign in, please.
Man, the Singular Network just took a shit.
Well, I kept right on going, and I was hoping. I'm like, I hope this is not somebody I'm about, because I'm not going to stop recording. I've been going the whole time. We still got about 5 or 6 minutes left.
Yes, is this Mr. Stink Dog? I need to talk to you.
Oh, man. Now, let me see. I was just finishing up, actually, our second topic. I was talking about the Java desktop system, excuse me. And I was just talking about how Java, and actually, you know, this is a perfect place for you to jump in. I was reflecting on how Java, when it first came out, really was such a great idea. It was just revolutionary to have a language that you could develop on that would work cross-platform. You didn't have to worry about not only different architectures in general, but different versions of, you know, Windows 98 versus Windows ME versus Windows XP. Well, that wasn't out at the time, but you know what I mean?
Right.
A great idea, and it started off fine, but then it just got so over-engineered and so complex and just downright buggy.
I don't know. I don't know if some of you know. I'm a Java programmer, or at least I like to call myself a Java programmer. It's my language of choice, even though I do C++ and some other languages. I prefer Java. It started out as an embedded system originally, you know, so you could have your Java coffee maker, or what was it, Java toaster.
Right.
That's what it was called. I will give it that it is becoming a bit more complex than it should have been. And a lot of people will knock how slow it is, we had this little competition in IRC. Yeah, a 500,000 lines of Hello World C will beat it hands down. But it takes a good Java programmer to actually make, you know, quick applications. There's a great article in, I think it's Java Developer Magazine this month. I get that. What does that tell you? I'm not a proponent for.
It tells me you
Java
need
in any way.
It tells me you're going to need group therapy. That's what it tells me.
But they have a great article about how, you know, the threading system between Java and, you know, Windows, for instance, is completely different. And a lot of what people see as Java being slow is just poor development. People will put, you know, the GUI handling code within the main computational loop, which causes a serious problem. You know, if you've got something that's waiting and the thread that's supposed to be handling the GUI updating is sitting there waiting on something, the GUI doesn't get updated, so it looks like it's slow as nuts. It's like, well, I just clicked this button and it's, you know, taking me 10 seconds to move on to something else. So, I don't know. I think Java's been getting a bad name lately, personally.
Well, the thing is, I mean, it's getting a bad name, but I don't... There are good Java programmers out there.
Oh, definitely.
I just think Java itself has become so incredibly over-engineered. I mean, okay, here's an example. I'll tell you when I started disliking Java. I was writing Java in what was then known as Forte.
Right.
Okay.
Which became NetBeans and Java One Studio and whatever the hell.
Exactly, and that's what I'm getting at. Back then, even that, it was, as the versions went up, it became more and more complex, but it was still usable. Sun got this wild hair up their ass and decided at some point that, you know what, I don't know, maybe you're going to disagree with me on this, but the intent of Java originally came across feeling like this is a free alternative, and I'm not using the word free, that they've stated that. It felt like, liberate yourself from only writing C, because at the time there was controversy with C# and J# and stuff, Microsoft trying to use their proprietary languages and stuff like that. And Java was like the foil to that. Java was on the other end going, you don't have to cave into Microsoft and use their languages and use their environments and their libraries and their runtime. They were totally the opposite feeling of that. We are the alternative. We can cross-platform. We can work on any platform. You write it once and we can do this and we can do... And it had that feeling of being for the people. Somewhere along the way, Sun, and it's probably about that time that they took over Forte and Sun 1 came out, which has been within, what, a year? A year and a half?
Right.
Maybe longer? I don't know.
Actually, Sun 1's even been renamed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I see. Well, at some point, Sun finally... I don't know, but I shouldn't say finally. Some Sun made the decision that, you know what? We shouldn't be making this so free and public. We should milk this and make money off of this. And what they have done is the same damn thing that Microsoft has done. They want to make proprietary stuff and proprietary this, and everything comes from Sun now. They've over-engineered it to death. Complete overkill of all of their products now. So that it's nothing more than a junior Microsoft. It's one proprietary system or the other.
Right.
And I think that's one reason that a lot of people have jumped off. They've changed from what it was originally intended, or at least what it seemed like was the original intent. I don't know what Sun originally intended, obviously, and if someone from Sun is listening, by all means, write me and defend it, because I think you're full of it myself. I think you guys started up with this, it was a great idea, and then you saw dollar signs. And you said, hey, you know what, the hardware thing isn't really, it worked for a little while, but we've leveled off, and we're not, you know, it's not doing as well with the hardware, so we need to start milking this, and they've taken it back, over-engineered it, trying to make it something that it shouldn't be, and I think they're in the process of killing it.
Right.
I don't know if it's too late now, I don't know if it's dead yet, but I think they're shooting at it.
Well, what's funny is, you know, Microsoft with their .NET is exactly what, I guess, what you're saying they're becoming. Because that was their biggest competitor was .NET, because .NET for Microsoft, at least, is supposed to be their cross-platform, their cross-language architecture, their product. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I guess, in a way, yeah, Java is becoming exactly that.
Yeah, and that's just... And, you know, and the other thing that always started to confuse me, too, was, I mean, okay, I understand Java, and I understand JavaScript. But then they started making all these Java beans, and then there was some other, what was the other derivation called? Let's see, there's Java server pages, Java beans, Java applets, Java. It was like there were so many different Java this, Java that, that it became confusing when to use which one.
In
retrospect, you can kind of put it together and you can see it, but it's like, why do we need all of these different types and flavors and names for the same Java? I thought Java was cross-platform and it was, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, you have to consider a lot of the things that have been coming out do completely different things. The language itself is the same, which is a good thing, because, I mean, if you consider, okay, you've got an application for developing desktop application. You've got a language for developing Java server pages, which is what you were talking about.
Right.
Which all uses the same language, which was a wonderful thing from a development standpoint, because, you know, if you're doing, let's say you're working on Linux, and you're doing desktop applications, you're doing web applications, you know, you don't have this language that can bridge between them. Like, for instance, you know, you do your applications in, we'll say C++, because if you're doing desktop applications in C, good luck, have fun, that's your thing. But, you know, any other language, and then all of a sudden you need another language to do the web development side of things, because you want your application to be able to link or to update a website or to pull information down from a website. All of a sudden you're doing PHP, and then now you're wanting to add things like embedded on your cell phones, or you have PDAs, you have PDA users that you want to be able to access data wirelessly, so now you've got another language. And so it all kind of comes, you know, even that becomes overly complex. But with at least the part that I like about it is, you know, you can write a Java 2 ME for your cell phone or for a PDA using the same language, the same syntax, that kind of thing. And
well,
I don't know if you've done much Java development lately, but Sun does offer probably the best documentation for any language I've ever seen. If you check out java.sun.com, they check out the API information. It's probably the most concise, easiest to read. I don't know. That's just me.
Well, when they, and that's another thing, J2ME, J2EE, J2, what, you know, there was, how many different versions of the compiler do you need? How many different names for different platforms, you know, it became confusing.
The problem is that, for instance, the J2SE, which is the standard, you know, the, what most people use, or compared to that to the J2ME, the problem is when you're working with embedded things, you don't have as much storage as you could possibly hope for. So you have to scale down the API somewhat. Okay, well, it doesn't need to do this necessarily, and it doesn't need to do this. Then, you know, you start having to pull out things you don't need, so obviously they had to have a different name for it. The J2EE and the J2SE, I think they're actually trying to get rid of those two different distinctions. I know in the latest, NetBeans is what it's called now for, was what Java Sun 1 Studios became. I think they're, you know, trying to get a lot of that out so you're not, you don't have all those, but they're still there.
Well, you also have another issue with the runtime libraries and the virtual machine, to be actually the
right.
Virtual machine problems with the lawsuits and how you really have to have Sun's virtual machine on your desktop now.
Right.
It sucks. It sucks, and it is slow. We use a Java-based application at work that is horrifically slow. And yes, of course it's true for any language that it depends on how it was programmed and how it was written. But I don't think that... without seeing the code, of course, I can't make that judgment call. But I know on a daily basis, I see pathetically slow-running Java applications.
Oh, and definitely. I mean, I can't argue that a lot of what you see is going to be slow. But a large part of that is, you know, obviously that it's an interpreted language. But the thing is, I don't know, for me at least, why Java is, that part of it isn't really a problem is because, obviously, computers are becoming so fast these days. And I think this is, you know, I think I had this argument before in IRC that, you know, people can program assembly all day long and they can write their text editor in assembly or whatever. You know, is it really worth the time it takes to develop in the language? You know, it may take you 10 years to do your damn text editor to save, you know, a whopping 2 cycles or something like that, or even, hell, 5 cycles, 10 cycles. It doesn't matter when you've got these machines that are clocked well over, you know, anything that we could have hoped for years ago. So
right, but
that to me, I guess, is the reason why it's not really that big of an issue.
But see, you're comparing it to assembly. I think
assembly to C. You know, you can write it in a higher level language. Okay, yeah, C is a little bit slower. And if you're a really good assembly programmer, you can, you know, save a couple cycles by doing this and that. But is it really worth it these days?
Well, I guess that's up for debate. I am of the opinion that Sun is teetering on the brink of shooting themselves in the foot, blowing off their big toe. You know what bottom line is? People want something. They want an alternative to Microsoft. They want something different to develop. They don't want .NET, believe it or not. Some of them are going to stick with it, but businesses are very happy. They don't want all their eggs in one basket.
Right.
There are... I would say most smart managers, anyway, know that you need to diversify. There are some cases when you want things to operate cleanly together and handshake with each other perfectly fine, but there are other cases where you want to distribute things. And frankly, I see an infinitely higher amount of people that have sucked it up and said, we have to go with .NET because Java doesn't cut it. So, and that's just from my professional experience. Maybe I've been at places that are, I don't know, biased or have a different feel, but I have it right here in the notes here. At the end of this article, which again was from eWeek magazine, the quote comes from comes from an anonymous IT manager. And it says, quote, "If Sun had the interests of the customer in mind, then the Sun desktop would be written in C and donated to Linux. Sun is no better than Microsoft. And if you listen to episode 26, I said that. The whole JDS, I also mentioned that it's coded with Sun products, the Sun desktop, the Sun, Star Office, the Java support developing, et cetera, et cetera. No, I don't, you know, why would I replace a proprietary Microsoft system with a proprietary Sun system with that is Java-based, which, again, in my opinion, is inferior to Microsoft right now. I think it shouldn't be. I think it could have been much better, but I think they've gotten... I think the dollar signs have blinded them, and they're trying to create it to be what used to be touted as being more accessible and more universal than the Microsoft products is now becoming a competitor to the Microsoft products instead. And I don't think that's what they meant. Or at least it didn't seem like it in the beginning. But, hey, what do I know? I know we're out of time.
All right.
I know that. I know your phone. What, did your phone die or something?
No, we have two, we have two cell phones here from the same company, the exact same phones. We have two of the Motorola T720s.
Right.
Being that some other people I know have.
Yep.
And literally, the network just cut out. I had full signal on the phones themselves, but they weren't getting anything. They couldn't dial numbers, so I'm assuming there was a problem somewhere up. It wasn't, this site. So I don't know. I couldn't call anybody. I even tried calling 911 for the hell of it.
Well, that's strange. I don't know that I've ever heard that before. Because it was out for...
About 3 months ago. No, it was probably longer than that now. 4 or 5 months ago. Some people may remember. Singular had a damn near nationwide failure.
Wow.
I mean, it was pretty big. Lasted for all of a day or so.
Yeah, I think it must have been out for, I don't know, what, 20 minutes? 15?
Yeah.
It was out for a good while.
A while back, they had a pretty big failure, which, and what was really bizarre, is that people in the same, I think I remember reading this on Slashdot, people in the same area, I mean, could be standing beside each other, and one person could call and three others couldn't. So.
Very strange. We are being watched. Big Brother is listening.
It's a man trying to bring us down.
That's right. They are trying to hold you down. I'm being repressed. I'm being repressed.
I was afraid the feds were about to break down my door. Calm before the storm.
Anytime a hacker's phone goes dead, you gotta admit there's a small tingling in the back of your head that says,
We were standing outside doing something the other day, and three cops rolled up outside of our front door.
Ooh.
To an apartment building. So I'm like, damn it, I forgot to do that remote control purge thing I was wanting to do.
Exactly, right? Yeah, I gotta work something like that out myself, I must say. But not because I have the Microsoft code. I made that clear in the show earlier. Just to throw that out there. Don't send me any cease and desist letters.
I never even had a desire to download it. This wasn't one of those things that I really care to see.
Well, and
not
it's
that
partial.
I feel like it's gonna make me a worse coder or anything. I just have no desire.
It's partial code, first of all, and I mentioned also earlier when I was talking that it's 3.5 years old. I think it's a lot of that is incorporated in XP. I know a lot of it's incorporated in Server 2003.
Well, 2000, it was source code from 2000 and NT4. And
right.
Basically, XP's code, or XP had the subname as NT5.1. And if you look, 2000 was actually NT5.0. So if that tells you anything, so obviously there's a large part of it in XP.
Absolutely, and I think even larger part in 2003 server.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I don't really care to see the source code for, Solitaire.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I might figure out a way to hack Sora the Solitaire.
Yeah, I know, man. My Minesweeper just doesn't go as fast as theirs, so, might have to take something from it.
You can go into the Minesweeper INI file and just manually edit that plain text, and you can give it... Go on there and put it in custom champion mode and put 1 second and put your name in there. I mean, that's already easy to do that. But
I haven't told you my story about my Minesweeper game. I'll tell you that some other time.
Okay, we'll save that for another episode. Now, as long as we're on the topic, I'll go ahead and give my shout-outs. And my shout-outs go to Microsoft for joining the open source revolution. Welcome aboard. Welcome to the open source community. Whether you meant to be here or not, whether it was voluntary or not, welcome aboard. You are now open source. You cannot put the source back in the horse. That's my shouts for the show.
I guess I got shouts, too. I'll give Digital Nutrition shouts for whipping my ass. thanks. It puts everything in perspective, you asshole.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I guess that's it for me. Yeah.
All right. And we are going to close again this week with another track from Brad Sucks, who we closed with last week. This time we're going to use a song called I Think I Started a Trend. And I've mentioned it several times before, but one last time, if you want to email us, radio@benrev.com. And Voodoo Al, thank you for being on the show and then not being on the show and then being back on the show again. I appreciate
having
you.
Again.
Does that count as two appearances?
Yeah.
And that is going to do it. So we will see everyone next week. Same hack time.
Oh, okay. I'll screw it.
Later.
Everybody said